This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Hampshire residents have seen it all before. Potential candidates positioning themselves for the first in the nation primary. The exploratory committees forming, the visits to small town diners, the stump speeches, and plenty of other opportunities to get their names and faces in front of the locals. Well, we're guessing that you have not yet heard of our next guest or the new political party that he's founded. Zoltán István is a writer, a futurist, a philosopher, and founder and presidential candidate representing the Transhumanist Party. He's been a guest on Word of Mouth in the past, so we were curious to hear more about his run for the president. Zoltán, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So your elevator pitch, please. What is transhumanism?
Well, transhumanism is really just an international movement that advocates for using science and technology to radically upgrade the human body and upgrade the human experience. But basically, we just want to, whatever we can do with science and technology to make the human being better, bionic arms, robotic hearts, telepathy, those kinds of things, we're into doing it.
So what's the party platform?
I think the biggest thing about it is that, most politicians, when they run across their political platforms, they're not pushing science and technology as their foremost concern. Well, the Transhumanist Party is. We're putting science, health, and technology at the forefront of everything we do politically. So when it comes down to talking about even taxes, or it comes down to defense, or it comes down to any of the major policy issues, we look at it from a very scientific and technological point of view and ask how science and technology can help those policies out.
Well, that's a question. I mean, if you're talking about transhumanism, how do you apply that to the issues that really matter to a lot of Americans? Say, gay marriage. What would the Transhumanist Party say about gay marriage?
Sure, and I've just written a very extensive article on the LGBT community. The Transhumanist Party is very pro the LGBT community. We consider a lot of the gay rights movement in the past kind of very similar to what the transhumanists are trying to do. We have some civil issues to work through because, after all, modifying your body, putting in brain implants, what transhumanists want to do, designer babies, these are all controversial civil issues. But, for example, with gay marriage, we're completely pro it. One of the key tenets of transhumanism and the Transhumanist Party is this idea of morphological freedom, the right to do with your body whatever you want to do, as long as it's not harming another person.
Okay. How about another issue that is preoccupying American politicians at the moment, the Keystone XL pipeline?
We are, of course, just like everyone else, wanting to push forth prosperity and commerce and also protect the environment. But there are some definite dangers there. I take, and this may not necessarily reflect the party's policy, because, of course, presidential candidate can have, some ideas that are slightly different than the party's. But I tend to believe that we need to push forward with commerce, economy, and things like that first and foremost, because what's going to happen is in 20 or 30 or 40 years, we are going to have the technological innovation to reverse a huge amount of the environmental damage that we have done to the planet. But in order to get to that kind of state 20, 30 years in the future, we're going to actually have to make more money, more resources, and take the planet to kind of the transhumanist age. But once we get to a level when we've created artificial intelligence and intelligences that can think better than us, we're going to have a huge onslaught of brand new technologies coming through the pipeline, including many really good environmental ones that will hopefully help fix the Earth. Because I do believe we've caused a lot of problems for the planet, but I don't want to stop economic progress. I think for transhumanists, economic progress is one of the main goals, because without it, we don't get to get our transhumanist technologies.
Well, that is a pretty optimistic view, that basically we can do the damage because we'll be able to fix it later. I'm not sure that climate scientists would agree with you that those kind of interventions are going to be as effective as you'd say.
Yes, I agree, and I've heard from quite a few of them. This is one of the more controversial policies of the, at least of my own self. And again, you have to realize that I have a long history personally with environmentalism. I've worked for National Geographic for many years, doing mostly environmental stories. And I've actually been on the director of Wild Aid, where I had worked with preserving endangered wildlife species. So I'm very much an environmentalist. But I also do tend to believe that we are going to come into new technologies that are going to dramatically change the way that we're able to apply science to the planet. For example, bioengineering, geoengineering. These are some brand new concepts that are out there that probably in 10, 15 years will be ready to be applied and will work.
Well, you mentioned transhumanism's goal to make lives better. Making lives longer is part of that. Transhumanism looks to a future where life extension through technology is pretty much the norm, right? But an indefinitely extended lifetime really does pose some logistical problems. I'm thinking of social security, of housing. So how do you balance this kind of optimism for future technologies with some of the realities that Americans face today?
We'll probably be able to conquer human death within 20, 30 years, but within 20 to 40 years, we'll probably be able to reverse aging. So that changes how long you're going to be in the workforce. You might remain 35 years old for the rest of your life, or you might get robotic parts in your body. You know, more and more people are getting artificial things. There's now robotic hearts in France occurring, and limbs and stuff like that. So the idea of how long we work is dramatically going to change. In fact, many of the social institutions of America and around the world are going to change as the transhumanist age comes upon us. Because if people live to 100, it's not just living to 100. If they can make it the next 20, 30 years, they're going to be able to live to 500, to 1,000, to whatever. So the entire idea of work, of retirement, Social Security, is going to be substantially changed if we can just make it 20, 30 years longer.
Zoltan, I'm curious about this idea of the we. As technology does continue to advance, how do we make sure that everyone has access to the benefits of longer life, artificial limbs, artificial hearts, better living, so that the gap between the wealthy and the poor doesn't grow even wider?
Absolutely. And this is the number one question that I actually get asked, because I think most people, when they hear about this, they think, okay, this is great, except the rich are going to get it first, and they're going to leave the poor entirely behind. I understand that worry, and I'm not of this uber elite or rich class myself, so I don't want to get left behind, especially for the technologies that I'm advocating for. What's happened is, I think, in the 20th century, you had a bunch of entrepreneurs, the J.P. Morgans, the Chases, they're pretty brutal with their economic policies. But if you look at the Bill Gates, the Elon Musks, the Mark Zuckerbergs, they're not the kinds of people that I think are going to either stop democracy or make it so that the poor don't have access to their technologies. Now, of course, people will have to pay, and it'll probably be expensive at first. The robotic hearts are something like $200,000 still. That's a classic technology that in 10 years, people might electively start replacing their heart, because heart disease is the number one killer in America. But if you can get a robotic heart and eliminate heart disease, it's a big win-win. But the problem is it's so expensive. However, like cell phones were 20, 30 years ago, they were super expensive too. And now if you go to even the poorest villages in Africa, people have cell phones. It just takes a while for the technology to trickle down. And I do believe that the entrepreneurs that are leading the technology companies now will make sure that their technologies are available to everyone as quickly as possible.
So you're looking at a very bright future. How about right now? Is transhumanism more likely to appeal to Democrats or Republicans or maybe libertarians, and why?
Well, it's all across the board, but certainly we have kind of a liberal basis of some extent, because in the end of the day, transhumanists want to allow people a lot more freedoms than are currently existing, at least in much of the social structure. This idea that you can do whatever you want with your body, this is somewhat radical to many conservatives, but I think liberals are pretty easygoing with it. And I think libertarians are also pretty easygoing with it, because in the end of the day, they also are just sort of like, hands off. Whatever the government's going to do, just keep your hands off. one of the things I'm doing, and I, first off, I'm running as a presidential candidate as an atheist. Now, the Transhumanist Party welcomes all sorts of religions, but I myself just happen to be an atheist. And I think, and some studies show this, that we are a community that is, we are a society that's moving a little bit more away from conservative ideas of religion, which in many ways do contradict some of the key transhumanist ideas, for example, living forever. If we can kind of move forward in that direction, I'm not saying in any way give up religion. I'm just saying if we can let go of some of the fundamentalism, we might get closer to being a more scientific and technologically minded society, one that is open to accepting how radical technology can actually change the world. It's not an overnight switch at all, but I certainly am promoting that and hoping that that kind of idea catches on rather than some more conservative ideas that sort of stand in the way of progress, in my opinion.
So then what do you think you can achieve in this election? Let's face it, it's not likely that you're going to win and become the next president of the United States. You may not even make it onto most state ballots. So what's the goal?
Yes, no, that is absolutely true. And I've been forthright with that from the beginning that it's likely we won't make it onto most state ballots. And it's almost certain that I wouldn't be able to win. But there's kind of two things here. It's important to get out there and try to spread the news that technology and science is arriving in a way in society that really is changing how we look at ourselves as human beings. And we need to examine that. I'm not saying we need to necessarily completely accept that. But, you know, most of the major political candidates are not talking about designer babies. They're not talking about how the military could use artificial intelligence. They're not talking about some of these key components that might really change society over 15 or 20 years. And the Transhumanist Party is. So we're hoping to interject into the national political conversation, some of these ideas, and hope that the major other candidates, the ones that will likely win, will at least look at them and maybe even discuss them. And second off, I think what's important is we're setting up a platform for 2020 and 2024 when the Transhumanist Party might actually grow to something like the size of the Green Party or the Libertarian Party. And who knows, if we got lucky and really got a lot of supporters, we might even become so big that we could potentially even win in 10, 20 years.
So, Zoltan, how are you planning on getting a foothold here in New Hampshire?
New Hampshire is one of our top 10 places, so I'm certain we're going to probably make it there. However, it's hard because I actually don't have that big of a transhumanist community right now. In New Hampshire, the biggest communities are in New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles. So it's really about kind of using our resources as best as possible. I guess all politicians sort of, they all need money. You know, that's really what makes this whole thing go around. So if we get the big sources on board, I will absolutely be there.
Well, Zoltan, we'll be looking for you at the diners of New Hampshire.
Oh, that would be great. I'll let you guys know if I'm there for sure. So I appreciate talking to you.
Zoltan Istvan, Transhumanist Party presidential candidate for 2016 and author of the novel The Transhumanist Wager. You find a link to find more about his candidacy and the Transhumanist Party at wordofmouthradio.org. You probably heard the Latin saying, in vino veritas, in wine there is truth. How about in online comments veritas? Up next, we're going to explore whether or not anonymous online comments provide windows into our true selves. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The digital age offers the opportunity to add your two cents to just about anything. The anonymity of online comment sections lowers inhibitions about posting reviews or beliefs or opinions, along with biting, sarcastic, harassing, hate-filled speech. But how do the comments we leave affect others? And what do they reveal about the person who posted them? Researchers are now digging into those questions and asking whether online comments provide windows into our true selves or just the one we're pretending to be. Anna North is staff editor of the New York Times Opinion Pages, and she explored this question in her article, What Your Online Comments Say About You. Welcome to Word of Mouth, Anna.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So among those researching what comments reveal about us, a team at Skidmore, they looked at the New York Times, Discover Magazine, and Facebook, and a Facebook group for science buffs, those comments. sound to me like fairly like-minded, civil kind of comment sections, are they?
You'd think. And in fact, they did find quite a number of very positive comments. You know, they looked specifically at some articles about gender bias, and they found a number of comments saying, you know, yes, this job is my experience. I've seen gender bias, or even, you know, we should work to fight gender bias. Unfortunately, they also found a fair number of sexist comments.
Any clue at all about who is doing the commenting, you know, gender, age, any kind of socioeconomic information?
Well, they did make some attempt to figure out the gender of the commenters. Obviously, you can't always do that reliably. They could do it in about half the cases. But they looked at things like the profile picture. Sometimes people use their name. Sometimes people would say something like, as a woman, I think this. So in those cases, it was easy. And they did find some differences between the ways that women and men would comment.
Like what?
Well, in particular, and I mean, this probably won't surprise that many people, you know, the women were much more likely to acknowledge that gender bias exists. They were much more likely to say, you know, yes, like maybe this jibes with my experience, or yes, I've seen this in action. Men were less likely to post comments like that. Unfortunately, men were also much more likely to post sexist comments. I believe they were a little more likely to post comments saying that gender bias could be justified in some way.
I guess the question about online comments are, you know, the idea that normal rules don't apply, social taboos don't apply, and one could actually be more truthful, like after you've had a few drinks at a party.
Well, I think, you know, some researchers do find that. In particular, a lot of researchers have done really interesting work on anonymity and showing that when no one knows your name, you know, you are much more likely to say certain things that you might not say otherwise, which might not always be bad. You know, it might be that you might be willing to have the kind of discussion that you would just feel too inhibited to have otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be upsides and downsides.
And you could actually reveal hidden prejudices, right?
Right, that's true. I mean, you know, that's something, you know, that the reporter at The Atlantic talked about. Well, you know, if there's truth in wine, you know, is there truth in online comments? You know, is this could be, you know, maybe a very fruitful ground to study, because these could be some prejudices people might be hiding in their daily lives. They might come out when you're online.
How about the way that those comments actually affect other people and how we perceive the article or the review or whatever we're reading?
Well, this is really interesting, actually. So what one researcher found, one team found, is that actually negative comments can really affect the way that we see the article, and can even, you know, change, for instance, you know, an article about a particular technology, if people even are just being uncivil to one another, you know, saying, you idiot, things like that. That can actually affect, can make us more skeptical of the technology that's under review, which is, to me, really fascinating.
Yeah, why is that? Any theories?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, what the study author mentioned was that even if we don't read the comments closely, we may skim them, you know, and we get these little bits of information, and those little bits can sort of be a lens through which we read everything else. So if our lens is all dirty, you know, with these, mm-hmm. you know, sort of negative comments, you know, maybe we start to view everything negatively.
Any evidence that comments can actually change minds? I mean, I've noticed, especially looking on things that are science-based, you're pretty much talking to a like-minded group of individuals with the occasional, you know, science denier in there. Any evidence that people's minds actually get changed by other commenters?
Well, there is some. I mean, a couple of things I would mention. One is, you know, I talked to some researchers who found that, and this is very timely right now because it deals with vaccines, that found that if you looked at sort of some public service announcements about vaccines and then you looked at the comments for those public service announcements, in some cases the comments could influence people's beliefs or people's perceptions about vaccines just as much as the public service announcements. And if the commenters identified themselves as someone who might have expertise in the area, such as a doctor, mm-hmm. then those comments could actually become more influential.
Uh-huh. There are a number of online publications that have opted to remove some or all of their comment sections. Do you think this is going to become a trend in the future?
I think it may. I don't know that it would ever, you know, be everything, because I think that a lot of news, you know, a lot of news outlets do value their community, and it can be a really good way to engage with people. On the other hand, you know, I think, you know, I have read some criticism saying if you can't moderate your comments, if you can't really be there for them, and you can't really, you know, you can't be filtering them the way that they sometimes would need to be filtered or managed, then maybe it's time for you to eliminate them.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're still relatively new in this idea of commenting with articles. It's still a little bit of the Wild West. Do you think that social norms are going to creep in and people are going to kind of rein themselves in a way that we do at the office, for example?
Well, this is what, this is what a lot of people actually hope. There are a lot of researchers working on norms online, how to try to create positive norms. And I think that there is research suggesting this is possible. There is research suggesting that, people do behave according to the norms that are established. And, I think certainly I would imagine that, the people who run a lot of online communities and social networks would hope that they can create positive social norms that would let people kind of stick around and feel safe there and feel like their views will be respected.
Are publications censoring free expression if they do take away comment sections?
Well, that's obviously sort of the trade-off, that's the trade-off with not allowing anonymity. It's the trade-off with any sort of commenter management. And I think, it seems like what a lot of researchers and probably social networks also would hope for would be some sort of balance where, people are free to say most things, but maybe you're not free to be abusive. Maybe you're not free to be threatening. There are some limits on free speech even, in real life. And maybe we would hope to place certain limits that would allow people to have the most productive conversation they can have.
Anna North, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Anna North, a staff editor at the New York Times opinion section. You'll find a link to read her article, which does include a robust comment section. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Stick around for more Word of Mouth. Up next, we're going to examine a unique approach to Earth's biodiversity, de-extinction, bringing extinct creatures back to life. That's when Word of Mouth returns. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier in the show, we spoke with Zoltan Istvan, the 2016 presidential candidate for the newly formed Transhumanist Party, a group that anticipates the stuff of science fiction becoming reality. During the interview, Zoltan said that while climate change is a real threat, he believes future technologies will be able to reverse the problem. In this story, we'll learn about scientists using similar principles to tackle another environmental issue, biodiversity. Producer Britt Ray has the story.
Isabella Kirkland paints animals, but animals that have been dead for a long time.
As I've been doing research for individual species that have gone extinct, it's been really tricky to work from specimens because sometimes they're old and discolored and moth-eaten. I have to be able to sort of turn it in my mind's eye and view it as an entire animal.
She should know. She's held the bones of the laughing owl and horns of the blue buck and even the eggs of the Syrian ostrich.
Every extinct thing I've held in my hands, I'll never forget the first time I opened a cabinet, someone opened a cabinet for me and I was able to hold them, and I kept saying, shouldn't I have a mask on and gloves and can I move it?
In a way, Kirkland's paintings serve as a visual time capsule for an apocalyptic future. Her painting Gone has 63 animals in it. Every one of them has disappeared since the colonization of the New World.
I begin each of the paintings that I do with a database, really. So I have a rubric like extinction or invasiveness or new discovery.
Gone looks like a Dutch master painting with a menagerie of animals on a table. There's the bright yellow and green Carolina parakeet perched on a twig. It died out in 1918. Below it sits the tiny golden toad. The last one was seen in the Costa Rican forests in 1989. Front and center is the most striking, Martha, the last passenger pigeon. She died in 1914 in the Cincinnati Zoo. Kirkland painted Gone so that we remember what has been lost, but now it's become the poster for a new scientific discovery that asks the question, what if we could bring the animals back? De-extinction.
It's my job to bring the bird back to life.
That's Ben Novak, a genetic biologist who's working to bring the passenger pigeon out of artistic imagination and back into the wild. Both Novak and Isabella Kirkland are working with the Long Now Foundation on a project called Revive and Restore. Bringing extinct species back to life is something out of a sci-fi movie, but this is reputable work. It's funded by universities like Harvard and UC Santa Cruz. This past spring, Revive and Restore held its first conference at National Geographic's headquarters.
Hello.
Novak presented on his leading effort at Revive and Restore, bringing back the passenger pigeon.
I want to bring them out of our imagination and get them back into the wild.
Or at least, a passenger pigeon.
The Great Comeback, as it is now officially titled.
At the turn of the 20th century, the birds flew in flocks of a mile wide. One flock was reported to be 300 miles long and took 14 hours to pass a single point. By 1914, we had hunted them out of the skies. And now their stuffed carcasses sit in natural history museums all over North America. You could say Ben has been planning this comeback since he was in junior high.
That's me when I was 13, doing science fair. Actually, I still have those pants. I wear those.
Back then, he created a science fair project about the dodo.
I was kind of in love with it at the time. I loved birds. I loved birds a lot. And the dodo bird, it was, you know, it's the icon of extinction, dead as a dodo, as they say.
And what I learned was the dodo bird happens to be a giant extinct pigeon.
And learning that about the dodo bird gave me the pigeon bug.
The idea behind it is simple, although the method is complicated, and Ben has teams of scientists working with him. They start by pinching the toe of a dusty passenger pigeon carcass to get its DNA. Next, they unravel it to read the code inside. Once Novak can read the DNA, he tries to find a closely related living match. Kind of like trying to find an organ donor. In this case, it's the band-tailed pigeon. And if it works, the band-tailed pigeon will give birth to a clone of a dead passenger pigeon.
I'm a little concerned about the passenger pigeon.
David Ehrenfeld teaches conservation biology at Rutgers University.
Let's say it works. There's no guarantee that it will, but let's say it works, and out of this egg laid by a band-tailed pigeon comes something with passenger pigeon DNA. The mother? The mother's not a passenger pigeon. Passenger pigeons and band-tailed pigeons eat different things. They have different calls. They fly differently. Is that band-tailed pigeon going to be able to raise a passenger pigeon?
Many scientists are skeptical about de-extinction. Not that it can't be done, but that it's pointless. Ehrenfeld thinks the passenger pigeon is a particularly bad candidate, since it lived in flocks of millions.
Let's say we bring back a heroic effort and bring back 20 passenger pigeons. What is going to happen? I'm not very optimistic about that.
But Novak says that if he can't bring the whole species back, even one bird is a major step towards understanding how to support the natural world that we love.
And I don't think anyone gets into these projects or even science, looking at graphs and looking at data, and that's all you see. When I look at DNA sequences, I see living animals. I see animals, you know, a pair of birds coming together and breeding to make some new offspring. I see these events in history that shape what this data actually looks like.
But if Novak succeeds, Isabella Kirkland might have to go back to her big painting, Gone, with all the extinct species on it, and update it, taking out the passenger pigeon. She'll have to find some new extinct animal to put in the center. Maybe the Sumatran rhino will show its head. Or maybe something else. There are, after all, and will continue to be, lots of candidates.
All I really want with the work is two things: to get people to slow down and think more. I just would like people to ask themselves the kinds of questions that the work asks itself. So, what does matter? We are animals that rely on a certain amount of hope, and I find this whole idea of de-extinction very, very hopeful.
And that was producer Britt Ray. Stay with us for another fascinating but relatively unknown story, the role that NASA played in promoting civil rights in the American South. We're going to hear about the first African Americans in the U.S. space program. That's after a short break.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When Jackie Robinson breached baseball's color line in 1947, it was an obvious watershed moment in America's troubled racial history. 14 years later, when NASA's Mercury 3 mission launched Alan Shepard into space, the efforts of a small group of black engineers and mathematicians was not so visible or even acknowledged. Now, more than 50 years later, the story emerges of how NASA had black and white people working together to put a man on the moon at a time when the law forbade them from using the same bathroom. Richard Paul is co-author with Stephen Moss of We Could Not Fail, the first African-Americans in the space program. And Richard Paul, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me. I am always excited to talk about this little piece of American history that seems to have completely disappeared.
Well, it is just an amazing story. Tell us, if you would, about the, I'm going to call him the Jackie Robinson of the space program, Julius Montgomery. Who was he? Where did he work?
Julius Montgomery worked at Cape Canaveral. And Cape Canaveral, for those of us who are old enough to remember the 1960s, was the place where all the moon rockets were shot from. But when he went there in the late 1950s, before it was called NASA, this was a place where they fired off missiles. And he was hired to be what was called a range rat. When a missile would misfire or blow up on the launch pad, the range rats would go out, figure out what was wrong, and fix it. And so that's what Julius was hired to do. He was the first African-American hired at Cape Canaveral. And it's a pretty significant thing because in the 1950s, the Ku Klux Klan controlled East Central Florida. And the sheriff of Orange County was a Klansman. There were city commissioners, aldermen, county commissioners who were in the Klan. There was one person who we were talking to in the book who told us that local businessmen joined the Klan almost like joining the Rotary Club. Mm. And here is this guy who walks in on his first day of work, and not only wouldn't they shake his hand, they wouldn't even acknowledge him. Mm. He says he walked up to these guys one by one. There were like 20 of them in the work group, and they just turned their backs. These days, it's also a wonderful story how he finally broke the ice. The way he told it to me, he said, "I got to the last guy. And he says, I held out my hand and I said, hello, I'm Julius Montgomery. And he said, boy, that's no way to talk to a white man. And Julius says, and I looked at him and I thought for a minute and I said, oh, excuse me, oh great white bastard, what should I call you? And he says, and he laughed and I laughed and he shook my hand. It's just an amazing story.
Well, and it begins before the passage of the Civil Rights Act with a Kennedy administration initiative to integrate NASA. Now, this is in the American South, so this was a political decision. What was behind it?
Well, President Kennedy never talked about civil rights during the campaign, and he never talked about going to the moon during the campaign. So whatever you think about John F. Kennedy's legacies, these were things that he fell into by accident. And it all started in April of 1961. There was a confluence of circumstances over the course of literally about 6 weeks in 1961. Yuri Gagarin becomes the first human being in space. So now the Russians are beating us in this important Cold War area. 8 days later, the Bay of Pigs disaster happens, and American-backed rebels are slaughtered at the Bay of Pigs. And now a Soviet ally is established 90 miles from Florida. On May 5th, Alan Shepard becomes the first American in space. And then 9 days later, the Freedom Rides start. And the Freedom Rides were a group of young people, black and white, they got into a bus in Washington, D.C., with whites in the back of the bus and blacks in the front of the bus, and drove down south to see what would happen. So that starts on May 14th. 10 days later, the bus is firebombed in Anniston, Alabama. And the next day, President Kennedy commits to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And a week later, the Freedom Riders bus goes to Montgomery, where there's a riot, and the governor declares martial law. Mm-hmm. So now within the course of 6 weeks, you've got civil rights on the front of the president's agenda and going to the moon on the front of the president's agenda. President knows he can't get a civil rights bill. There is no way Congress is even going to debate it, let alone pass it. So he decides that he's going to turn to executive action. And the executive action that he's got at hand is federal hiring and federal contracting. So he passes an executive order that says that federal agencies can't discriminate on the basis of race, and nobody that gets a federal contract can discriminate on the basis of race. And he does this at exactly the time that NASA is beginning to hire 200,000 people, mm-hmm. principally in Alabama, Texas, Florida, Mississippi, and Louisiana.
So at the same time that NASA has to staff up, there is this challenge to find trained people, never mind African Americans who have been denied the same kind of educational opportunities. Among the hires, Charlie Smoot, the first Negro recruiter, in quotes. How did he find qualified African Americans to work in the space program?
So Charlie was hired around 1963. Up till now, when in the rare instances when they would go to black colleges, they'd send white recruiters. And there was nothing a white recruiter could tell a young African American man that would make him feel secure about going to Alabama or Florida or Texas. They knew they couldn't use the same toilet as their coworkers. They knew that they would probably get lynched if they were walking at night in the wrong place in Florida. How is a white man going to convince a black man to come and work for NASA? Charlie Smoot was amazing. And I've talked with people who were recruited by Charlie Smoot who said, you know, the white recruiters told me all this stuff. I didn't believe what they had to say, but Charlie Smoot convinced me to come and work at NASA.
And Smoot also notes that the vetting process for the African Americans was much more stringent than for the white students.
Yes, it really, really was. First of all, NASA was largely staffed by Southerners, by white Southerners. So you had people from Vanderbilt and Georgia Tech, people with technological educations who would come to NASA. So first of all, you've got this Southern white workforce. And the second thing is, NASA, because it was a technology agency, was able to run around the government standards about hiring and find people in ways that, you know, bureaucratic institutions couldn't normally do. And as a result, it had a corporate culture that saw itself as different, as outstanding, as above the normal government agency. Combine this sense of, you know, being an outstanding agency with being an agency staffed by Southerners who did not, in the main, see African Americans as equal to whites, and you can understand why supervisors at NASA would spend extra time trying to vet the African Americans because they just weren't sure that they could cut it.
So Charlie Smoot helps to identify seven recruits. A little bit about them and their respective jobs.
Sure. They were all from Southern University Baton Rouge, and they went together as a group to the Marshall Space Flight Center when NASA opened their co-op program to African Americans in 1963. They worked in quality assurance. NASA was filled with redundancy. And so there were tests and then tests of tests and then tests of tests and tests. To a large extent, that's what they were hired to do. Morgan Watson, who was one of them, went on to work in propulsion and helped design the heat shields on the Saturn V rocket. So he went a bit farther. George Borda, who was one of them, said to me, he said, you know, I look white. And if you see pictures of him, he has very Caucasian features. And he said, occasionally I'd be sitting around with the other guys and they would forget that I was black. And they'd say the things that they really had on their minds. Mm-hmm. And they didn't think we could cut it. The way he put it was, he said, we felt that the entire image of black people in America was riding on us and we could not fail. If they failed, people wouldn't say, oh, Morgan failed, or oh, George failed. It would be, you know what, I told you those people didn't belong at NASA. And the fact that they showed up every day and did the amazing work that they did is a civil rights victory of a different sort.
Yeah, you're careful, I think, not to present them as some kind of vanguard, but we get their individual stories. I'm wondering if African Americans in the country were following that story. Did they know that these so-called Negroes were helping to put a man on the moon?
One of the reasons that this history has been lost is because these stories were not covered in the white press, but the black press was all over it. anytime someone was working at NASA, they were on the covers of magazines. They were on the front page of newspapers because the African-American community at that time, I think, was trying to demonstrate that they could be on par with the white community. I mean, especially in the South, but also in the North, blacks were kept so far behind that there really was a desire to show, look, we can work as hard as you. We can do as well as you. And NASA at the time was the pinnacle of scientific and technological achievement. And if there was a black man working at NASA, oh my goodness, he was on the front page of everything. One of the stories, I'll tell you this as quickly as I can, is a guy named Ed Dwight. Now, Ed Dwight never became an astronaut. He was two or three steps away from being an astronaut trainee. But when NASA placed him on the track to become an astronaut, he was on the cover of every single black magazine. He was on the front page of all the newspapers. He got invited to come and speak all over the country. In many ways, in 1962, Ed Dwight was the black John Glenn.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody has heard about Ed Dwight anymore. Mm-hmm.
Well, Richard, this is a very different narrative than we've had of people getting over on the Jim Crow South in the civil rights movement. Would these people who worked at NASA, would they be criticized for passing or playing Uncle Tom's even by more radical elements of the civil rights movement?
You know, it's hard to get inside of people's minds and answer a question like that. But one experience that I can talk about with authority is that of Julius Montgomery. Julius ran for political office in the mid-1960s, and he said that he carried all of the white precincts and none of the black precincts. People in his community couldn't understand how he got such a good job. They couldn't understand how he was able to have so much responsibility. And he said, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I had a first-class radio telephone license. I studied real hard to get that license, and I got the job because of it. He said that there were times when he couldn't get a ride home, mm-hmm. when his black coworkers would not drive him back to the neighborhood. And it was something that I think always perplexed him and probably, I don't know that it angered him, but it was certainly something that gnawed at him for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. There's a heartbreaking story you tell of Frank Williams, finally finding him. He's one of those first six black engineers from Baton Rouge. Mm-hmm. Finally, you reached him in 2008, living in New Orleans, and his daughter had no idea of what he had achieved in the space program. I mean, it's like there's this kind of submerged continent of the past. Is that the same for all of the other African-Americans who worked at NASA in the 60s?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, George Borda likes to talk about how now there are eight engineers among his children and grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, and they all know what I did and they all followed along. But the story of Frank Williams is really, really sad because I mentioned to his daughter when I first called, I produced a documentary on this subject back in 2008, and I had called her and said, you know, your father, there was an article in the New York Times, and he was called a social pioneer, and he was one of the first African Americans at NASA. And she said, wait, he was what? And so I told her about it. She said, oh, my, this is wonderful. Yes, we'll definitely do the interview. But she said, I have to tell you, my father is very sick. He had mesothelioma, which is a lung disease. Mm-hmm. And we went to do the interview. We hired somebody to hold a microphone in front of him while I interviewed him over the telephone, and all he could do was cough. Mm-hmm. And we tried this for about 5 minutes, and his daughter just came on the phone just crying because she said, not only did I want my father to be part of this history in the documentary, but I'd never heard these stories before. I wanted my father to tell me these stories. And a few weeks later, she sent me an email saying that her father had died.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, at the funeral, we asked people to get up and tell stories. And this man got up named Morgan Watson, who I didn't know who this man was. And he had all these stories about my father. They had gone together to NASA in Alabama. And he was telling all these stories and how they went to a lunch counter at night one night in a bus station. And my father stood up to make sure that they got served at the whites-only counter. And after the funeral, at her father's funeral, she walks up to this man and says, I don't know whether you know, but there's a guy who's writing about the first African Americans in the space program. Would you mind if I gave him your telephone number? And that's how the whole thing started.
Richard Paul, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Richard Paul, he's co-author with Stephen Moss of We Could Not Fail, the First African Americans in the Space Program. Richard also produced a terrific hour-long documentary called Race and the Space Race, and it's narrated by Mae Jemison, the first African American woman in space. You can find a link to listen to it and more on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety on the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.